1 o'clock tomorrow morning for that, here on BBC Radio 3. More music by William Byrd in the early music show with Catherine Bott in a couple of minutes, but now at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC News. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said allegations that the intelligence services circumvented the law to gather data on British citizens are nonsense. GCHQ has been accused of monitoring emails, photos and videos from material gathered by an American agency. Mr. Hague confirmed that he'll give a statement to Parliament on the allegations tomorrow. A senior Conservative MP, Tim Yeo, has denied claims that he used his position as chairman of a Commons committee to help a private company influence Parliament. Mr. Yeo was secretly filmed by reporters from the Sunday Times. The paper alleges that the former Environment Minister coached the boss of a firm before the businessman gave evidence to the committee. Mr. Yeo has referred himself to the Parliamentary Standards Watchdog. Police are treating an overnight fire at an Islamic boarding school in London as suspicious. More than 120 pupils and staff were moved from the Darul Uloom school in Chislehurst late on Saturday night. Two men were treated for smoke inhalation. At least 27 people have been killed and more than 70 wounded in the Libyan city of Benghazi in clashes between protesters and a militia allied with government forces. The violence broke out when protesters gathered outside the headquarters of the Libya Shield Brigade, demanding that it be disbanded. North and South Korea have held their first official talks in more than 2 years. Officials met at a village on the border to discuss plans for a ministerial-level gathering. Prayers have been said at churches in South Africa for the country's former president, Nelson Mandela, who spent a second night in hospital with a lung condition. Mr. Mandela is breathing unaided and he remains in a serious but stable condition. Tennis and the men's final of the French Open gets underway in an hour's time. Rafael Nadal is bidding to become the first man to win the same Grand Slam title, singles title 8 times. He's playing his fellow Spaniard David Ferrer. And the weather. The warmest and sunniest of it will be in the west, but a few showers may develop in northwestern Britain. Maximum temperatures of around 18 degrees for Celsius, although they'll be just 13 degrees in some eastern coastal areas. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02. So now it's time for the early music show. And today, Catherine Bott's second of this weekend's programmes, celebrating the life and music of William Byrd.
Alfred Deller with the Wenzinger Consort performing William Byrd's Come Pretty Babe to begin our second instalment of this celebratory pair of early music shows commemorating William Byrd, the great Renaissance English composer. With me again is Andrew Carwood, Director of Music at St Paul's Cathedral in London and also Founder-Director of the Cardinal's Music. Welcome back, Andrew. Now, this is a fascinating pair of vocal items from William Byrd that we're going to hear, and you've got a story about the one we've just heard and the next one that connects them.
I won't claim responsibility for the story. It's John Harley who suggested it as a possibility, another one of the great Byrd researchers. You just heard a lullaby, essentially, albeit a slightly sad one, about a deserted mother, which is, you know, is often the way with lullabies. That can be about quite difficult subjects. And the piece that is going to follow is one of Byrd's madrigals, Lullaby, My Sweet Little Baby, which is very clearly about the Christ child and the difficulties of getting him to sleep with all the nastiness that will be going on around in his life. But John Harley has suggested that both of these pieces might have been written for the birth of one of Byrd's children, possibly Thomas, in 1576. Byrd doesn't seem very often to write things which are relevant to his family or to his life in any way. But these two, it's thought, might fall into that category, which would be rather lovely.
And he was happily married for many a long year and sired several children, didn't he?
Yes, I always have to remind myself not to be too romantic about these things. He was married for a long time. I hope it was happy. We have no empirical evidence to that effect. But yes, I mean, it was a long relationship. And yes, there were children, and there doesn't seem to have been too much trouble. I mean, his wife gets more censures for being a Catholic, by the by, I should say, in passing, than Byrd does. And they still stay together, so they must have loved each other quite a lot.
Let's agree that they did, yes. And let's hear Lullaby, My Sweet Little Baby.
Thank you.
Bird's Lullaby for the Christ Child, Lullaby My Sweet Little Baby, sung by Pro Canzione Antiqua. Now, Andrew Colwood, appreciation of Bird's music, has it been a constant thing since he was alive? I mean, it's fairly routine that when a composer dies, his reputation takes a dip and he's then discovered a few decades later as if for the first time. What happened to Bird's reputation, and what about the early music movement of the last century?
Yes, well, I mean, thanks to the Church of England and the growth of the choirs in the 17th century, albeit with the blip of the Civil War, some of Bird's music in English absolutely did stay. And so it was either music written for the church originally in English, like the second service, which we heard yesterday, or some music in Latin, which was then turned into English. So Bow Thine Ear is an anthem, which is actually a setting of Civitas Sancti Tui. And those pieces seem to become very popular. So in the cathedral music lists, there's always a little bit of Bird, which goes all the way through. But essentially, he was forgotten about, I would say, pretty swiftly, as composers were then, because you think of Bach. Bach writes a cantata and you sing it next Sunday. And then, of course, when Bach dies, his reputation similarly declines fairly fast. And so it was with Bird. And all of those great Renaissance composers, except Palestrina, who's just different and wonderful in a different way, until the beginning of the 20th century. That was when the big revival happens. Richard Terry at Westminster Cathedral started digging around with stuff. The Tudor church music editors started looking at it all. And that's really when we started to appreciate how great the music was again. And then it came back in through the cathedrals and the rise of the great chamber choirs.
Well, you've chosen for our next music a piece of instrumental music that really exemplifies the dangerousness of the early music show sometimes, because a lot of people, I know, do not like to hear early music keyboard stuff played on the piano. But you have, Andrew Carwood, you have chosen Glenn Gould playing Selinger's Round. And I'm going to ask you, not 25 times like Jeremy Paxman, I'm going to ask you why.
I'll try not to avoid the question. I have to say, I'm not always a very good early music person. Sometimes people accuse me of being far too romantic about this period of music when I do it. But first of all, I mean, Glenn Gould is an astonishing musician. I don't like every performance that everybody does of every single piece of music. I think this is a particularly fine piece. What I think he's got is an extraordinary understanding of the energy and the style. I mean, you listen to the turns and the ornaments in this and the articulation. It's absolutely superb. And it's a glib thing to say, lots of people say it, but I'm sure Bird would have written for the piano if the piano was around. He wrote for everything. Apt for voices and viols, to power, you know,
and
as we
pianos.
Said yesterday, and pianos. And I think this is a great piece. It's full of energy. It's a tune which Bird harmonises. And I think he captures the spirit of it in a very clean way. And I hope the diehard early music listeners would agree as well. Thank you.
pianist Glenn Gould with Selinger's Round by William Byrd. Andrew, you've chosen more church music for us to hear now. We've started with some solo vocal and madrigal and keyboard piece. Now we are back to the Mass for Five Voices, the Sanctus. Where does this fit in Byrd's long career of church music writing?
Well, these mass settings, there are three of them, of course. The mass for three voices, then four voices, then five voices, which we've got a bit of here. These pieces are really pivotal, I think, in his life. They come from the 1590s, we're pretty sure. This is when he moves out of London. He says, I've sort of had enough of London, I've had enough of the court. He buries himself in the countryside of Essex, in a Catholic community, and he writes a setting of the mass in Latin. Now, there's no one using the mass in Latin in the Church of England. So it's not for Lincoln, it's not for the Chapel Royal. Who's it for? It's for that community in Essex, I'm pretty sure.
Recusant households.
Recusant households. So people celebrating the Mass in fear of the spies, which would be outside everywhere, waiting to see what was going on. And of course, you know, you can over-romanticise this, but priests died, people died, they were tortured, and they died for their faith.
Well, there was a particularly bloody decade, wasn't there? The 1580s was exceptionally stained with blood of people who were on the wrong side of something.
Fairness, you know, to Elizabeth and her government, because one mustn't be romantic about this, the country was in a state of war. Not only had Spain declared war on them, but the Pope had excommunicated Elizabeth. There were foreign spies, there were people attempting to undermine the legitimate government of the country. And they had to respond in a way that they thought was fit. I think it was a little bit extreme, you know, simply to just murder priests because they were priests is extreme. But I can understand the fear,
the climate in which that could take place. Yes, and indeed, as you have previously mentioned in our discussions, William Byrd himself was comparatively safe as long as perhaps he kept out of the way in Essex. But members of his family were arrested. They weren't nearly as well protected as he was.
And his wife. As I said, his wife received more censures for not going to church than he did. So there really is the protective bubble around him, and it is him, rather than just the rest of them. I mean, again, what's astonishing about these masses is that his publisher published them, albeit without a title page, because that really would be holding a red rag up to a bull. You know, here's a mass in Latin by William Byrd. Look, everybody, would you like to buy it? Is effectively what they would be doing. And they didn't do that, so there's no frontispiece to it. But when you open it up, there it is.
What's known about how many people did buy these masses?
Well, we know that the 1575 publication was not well supported, and to be honest, I don't have figures for the masses, for exactly how many were sold. I don't think Byrd made, or his publisher made, a huge amount of money from any of their publications. I think it was very early in the days of publishing music for that to happen. And of course, a lot of these pieces were circulating manuscript beforehand, which is how they got...
Samizdat.
Yes. That's how they compose. That's how they learn their compositional technique through...
Yes, I suppose he couldn't really expect to make money because it was a brave man or woman who went out and said, I'd like one of these masses in Latin, please.
Exactly, yes. Have you got any of those new masses? Yes, because no, let's not forget, no mass in England since 1550, I'd say. Shepherd Cantate or Talis Puernatus. That's the last time we've had a Latin mass. So it's half a century, nearly.
Thank you.
The 16, directed by Harry Christophers in the Sanctus from Byrd's Mass for Five Voices. Confrontational stuff performed, we imagine, originally in more or less secret. Now, Andrew, you've chosen a piece that you've already said is pretty wacky for our next music. Tell me about O Salutaris Ostia.
It carries a health warning with it. The first time we sang it, the first time the Cardinal sang it, we just refused to believe that it was right. It couldn't be right. It's quite early. I think it exists in manuscript. Byrd chooses not to publish it. And that's not necessarily a guide to a piece being early or not highly esteemed. It seems to be a little bit random about what he chooses to publish. This is, I suspect, a piece where he's pushing the boundaries and learning a little bit. So it's a canon. It's a canon in three parts, three voices singing in strict canon, which is how we know the notes are right. Because all of the naughty notes are caused by the part singing this canon. So when we started to look at it, then we realised it's right. And just to explain, the canon works by that one person sings a tune, and then another person sings the same tune a few beats or bars later at a slightly different pitch, a complementary one, a fourth or a fifth, or occasionally at the same pitch. And in this case, there is also a third voice which sings the same tune a little bit later and at a different pitch. And they all fit together like a very complicated jigsaw. And the other three voices, because this is a six-part piece, are weaving around it, the most beautiful embroidery of harmonies. And it's a piece in honour of the Blessed Sacrament. So that's a bit unusual because there's sacramental change. It's not just the bread, it's become something special. And Byrd gives us this rather spooky, unlikely, eyebrow-raising piece, which is almost as remarkable as the change that happens to the sacrament itself.
O salutary victim who expanded the door of heaven, give strength, bear aid. Words by Thomas Aquinas, O Salutaris Ostia, set by William Byrd in staggering, almost contemporary music-like intricacy. Absolutely fascinating to listen to. Sung there by the Cardinal's Music, directed by my guest on the Early Music Show today, Andrew Carwood. Andrew, we're changing tack. You've chosen an in nomine. And you know something I've never asked myself. In nomine, in the name, in nomine domini, in the name of the Lord, you'd think that's going to be a vocal piece. But they never, ever are. Not only that, they're always written for viols, aren't they, in nomines? An answer, please, Mr. Carwood.
It's interesting, because we've already said, haven't we? And we keep repeating this phrase, apt for voices and viols. And yes, you're right. Nobody would ever think, oh, I'll just put some text to the in nomine. I think the reason is probably the way it expands, because the in nomine that is referred to, the title in nomine, which you correctly say, in the name of the Lord, is taken from a tune from a mass by John Taverner from the Missa Gloria Tibi Trinitas. And people thought this section, in nomine domini, which is part of the Benedictus, so that's the one of the later movements after the Sanctus, they thought this music was so beautiful, this tune that he wrote for in nomine domini, that they used it as a theme in order to expand with their own music. So I suspect the reason why is that it was never considered for texting, and it would be quite hard to fit the text to it, because the words is simply in nomine domini. And some of these pieces are 5 or 6 minutes long, and it would be very hard to repeat those words over and over again. So that's probably why it stayed in the realm of instrumental writing. And of course, as the years went on, it was very popular. It carried all the way through the 16th century. And as these pieces went on, they became more complex and more expanded.
Yes, we should say that well into the second half of the 17th century, Purcell wrote some for viols, by which time the viol was almost dead in the water as a trendy instrument, but he brought the whole idea of the viol consort back to astonishing life with some more really avant-garde writing.
Yes, and of course it's come back again in the 20th and 21st century. Modern composers have returned to it again, which is fascinating.
Well, it's a very special sound, isn't it? Mm. So the idea of in nomine and what it meant didn't have to be explained in Byrd's time because everyone knew. Phantasm with an in nomine in five parts by William Byrd. Now we have a song, it's going to be very tragic, I think, Wretched Albinus. Tell me about that, Andrew, why you've chosen it.
Yes, well, it's this is one of those funeral elegies. We heard one yesterday, the Lament on Talis. This is a lament for a gentleman called Albinus, who was a British governor, who, according to legend, rebelled against the Roman Republic and was then brought to account and executed. And, of course, it's not a huge step in the 16th century mind to go to another great British person who comes to high office and then rebels and is executed. And that, of course, is the Earl of Essex, who is a great favourite of Queen Elizabeth I and a source of huge heartache to her when he leads a rebellion. So Byrd is interesting in these funeral elegies. He treads a very dangerous path. He quite often writes pieces which are definitely on the Catholic side. So he writes an elegy for Queen Mary, Elizabeth's sister, Queen Mary. He also writes one for Mary, Queen of Scots. And here's another one for a figure going against the Queen. So it's a dangerous path that he treads.
He must have felt very secure and confident.
I think he must have been. I mean, he doesn't publish all of them.
Right.
Again, we've talked about this in terms of the masses. You know, they were very brave about publishing the masses, but not all of these are published. So it could be a personal gift to someone, as well as showing his own Catholic interests.
And, of course, rather like early Hollywood films, particularly the end of the silent era, they could have really quite erotic storylines, as long as the films were set in Europe. I believe that was part of the Hays Code. So Greta Garbo is in some Ruritanian country getting up to no good with John Gilbert. She couldn't possibly do it in small-town America. And here we have definitely something with a bit of a political agenda, but it's safely set in the days of the ancient world.
Exactly. I think you're exactly right to use that analogy, because censorship has often been like that in the theatre as well. If you can remove it from the contemporary society and put it somewhere else, then it's more acceptable. It's one of the reasons why Mozart's Figaro is so shocking, because it doesn't take it away. It puts it in another country.
It was in the here and then.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
James Bowman and the Richecar Consort, directed by Philippe Pierlot, in Bird's Lament for Poor, Wretched Albinus. Andrew, we're coming to our last music, and this is another piece that leaves one a bit speechless. I know that you will be able to find the words, but in Felix Ego, there's not really any comfort to be found.
There's some light towards the end, a little bit, but no, essentially, it's pretty bleak. It is effectively a monologue, I think. You may think that's a strange thing to say about a piece that's in six parts, but so intense is Bird's understanding of the emotion in the text that it's as if there's one voice speaking, because, of course, it is written by one person, as all texts are, the Dominican friar, Savonarola, who does a very brave thing. He overthrows the Medici in Florence. No mean feat, actually. You know, these ghastly people who were immoral and having a fabulous time, probably, but doing immoral things. Savonarola comes along and says, we can't behave like this as human beings.
He was sort of Occupy Florence, wasn't he?
He was. And it was implausible, really, that he should be able to stir the people up. He's a great preacher. That's not implausible. But, you know, to be able to turn people and throw the Medici out. And then, of course, he said, right, well, from now on, we don't have any of this immorality, and we don't do the other, and we don't drink.
Bonfire of the vanities.
Exactly. And it didn't take long for the people to think, actually, we don't like this very much, and the Medici don't seem so bad now, so they came back, they got them back in. And Savonarola was executed, not for treason, but for heresy, which is a really nasty thing to do to a Dominican friar, and absolutely...
Yes, it's gratuitous cruelty, really, yeah. Isn't it?
And he was burnt. Mm. And you can still see, there's a little square you can stand on in the Piazza della Signoria.
I have done.
Exactly, and says this is where it was. And allegedly, before he, the nights before he dies, he writes this meditation on the Miserere Mei, have mercy on me, O God, in Felix Ego. The context of this is, I am very unhappy, I'm in this terrible state, and I don't know why. I'm trying to look up to heaven, I try to find some sucker up there, I can't even get my eyes upwards. And it works through all this, and it comes down to, what am I going to do? How can I get over this? And the answer is the love and the mercy of God is how you get through it. And there is the most astonishing chord change in the last section of this piece, where the whole thing just shifts around, and the light, the sun comes out from behind the clouds, and you see what the answer is. It's like that Christopher Marlowe line, when the angel says to Faustus, do you not see the blood of God running in the heavens? If you can just reach up and touch it, you can have salvation. It's that moment for me. It's that the light that comes out, and there is the salvation. And I think for Bird, and we're back to the Catholic thing here, that for the Catholic community saying, why has this happened? What have we done wrong? What is the problem? How do we keep going? The answer is, regardless of what's happened, the mercy of God. That's what gets you through, and that's what I think this piece is all about.
Thank you.
perhaps a chink of light at the end of In Felix Ego by William Byrd. Well, Andrew Carwood, it's been terrific to enjoy celebrating the genius of William Byrd with you over these two programmes. I'm aware that we haven't done lots about details of Byrd's life story in chronological order. We've just been quite impressionistic about him. But it's obvious your enthusiasm is never going to wane.
I hope not. I really do think he's wonderful. And, of course, he's such a part of our musical life now. We've heard so many of our friends performing over the last 2 days in wonderful performances. And I think that's set to continue because he's so good. I keep coming back to that fact. He's just so good.
Thank you very much, Andrew Carwood. And thank you very much, William Byrd.
And so say all of us. Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. And Catherine is back next weekend for two more programmes celebrating two British composers, Benjamin Britten's lifelong love of the music of Henry Purcell. Do tune in for the first of those next Saturday afternoon, just after the 1 o'clock news.
Oblique strategies are a pack of cards developed by Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt.
On BBC Radio 4, Simon Armitage explores creative possibilities.
The most important thing is the thing most easily forgotten. Originally with a view to being used in a recording studio for when people were, you know, banging their heads against brick walls. Gardening, not architecture.
The force that drove Brian Eno and David Bowie to create the Berlin Trilogy albums.
There's one here, and all it says on it is reverse.
Oblique Strategies, on Thursday morning at 11:30 on BBC Radio 4.
Here on BBC Radio 3, in just a moment, our Sunday concert featuring two Sibelius symphonies. Do stay with us. A Shakespeare setting by Sir Hubert Parry. Oh, Mistress Mine. That was recorded in the music room of Parry's boyhood home, Hynham Court in Gloucestershire. The baritone was William Daisley and the pianist Ian Burnside. And Parry is Donald MacLeod's new Composer of the Week this week here on BBC Radio 3. Join him for the first of those programmes tomorrow at 12 midday. That's part of our month-long celebration of British music, which continues in Drama on 3 tonight. The subject of that, Sir Edward Elgar struggling to express in music the horrors of the First World War. His family and admirers try to help him reignite his creative spark. That's Elgar's Rondo by David Parnell, our Drama on 3 tonight at 8:15. It's a little after 2 o'clock now here on BBC Radio 3. Time for our Sunday concert, which was recorded in Manchester yesterday. It's presented by Patrick Trelawney.
Hello, welcome back to the Bridgewater Hall for the second in a trio of concerts in which the BBC Philharmonic perform a complete cycle of Sibelius's symphonies under the baton of chief guest conductor John Storgards. The series began with the first and fifth symphonies on Thursday night. You can still listen to that concert at the Radio 3 website. And there's an even greater contrast between the pair of works today. A Nation Awakes in what is Sibelius's most performed symphony, the second. before it will hear the fourth, declared incomprehensible at its Finnish premiere and later labelled his Cubist Symphony, illustrating the sharp contrast between it and the romantic language of some of his earlier works. In this country, it took a groundbreaking performance at the 1912 Birmingham Festival for the symphony to receive the detailed, inquisitive examination it so deserved. Even so, it remains the most challenging of his symphonies. The inspiration came from a trip Sibelius made in 1909 to Lake Pajalinen in the north of his beloved Karelia, the region of Finland whose culture, traditions and peoples inspired so much of his work. After the premiere, one newspaper published a detailed description suggesting the piece portrayed a journey to the lake, the first movement an impression of Kolli, a prominent local mountain offering spectacular views, the third a panorama of the mountain bathed in moonlight, and the finale a homeward journey through the darkening shadows of an approaching snowstorm. Here's what John Storgards thinks of the work.
In the Fourth Symphony, he's really himself, and he's really inventing something totally new in the general colors of that piece. He was very interested in what was going on inside the music field towards modernism around him. I feel that it must have had a lot of connection to how he felt as a human being that time when he was working with it. One knows that he had some problems, he was afraid of his health, and there were some clear reasons for that. He couldn't use alcohol and he couldn't use his cigars as much as he would have wanted to, and that was very much for him a big thing. I'm sure that must have irritated him a lot in many ways. In this symphony, he gets into something which on the surface maybe is easy to see as something very introvert and more different than anything else in all his symphonic output. But if you look closer into this piece and if you get involved with it, you find a lot of beauty in it too.
Yuri Tuchinski, leader of the BBC Philharmonic, takes his place on the platform here in Manchester. The lights are dimmed. The orchestra stands now then as John Storgards walks onto the stage to conduct Sibelius's Symphony No. 4.